Probably enough light, Bess said. I don't know, it can get dark in some of the corners. You sure as hell wouldn't want to get in the cages with the tigers before you knew they were asleep. Then what? They carry them out? How much does a tiger weigh? A lot, Landseer said. Artur, that's the male, was 648 pounds at his last weigh-in. Katya, the female, was 380 pounds. Virgil held up a finger. Wait, that's more than 1,000 pounds altogether, a half ton. If they're that heavy, they'd need some kind of mechanized equipment to get them out. Even if they had four people, they'd be humping more than 150 pounds each to get the male cat out. That doesn't seem realistic. I asked about that, and nobody heard anything mechanized, White said. The holes in the fence aren't that big. There were 14 people here on duty at the time. Nobody heard anything unusual. How many were out in the area of the tiger exhibit? Virgil asked. 12 of the people are basically cleanup and maintenance. 2 of them are security guards, and the guards circulate. They don't have any set routes, but they cover the whole zoo a few times a night. Why didn't they see the cut fences? Duncan asked. Not that easy to see in the dark, McCall said. I'm not defending the guys, but that's the fact of the matter. You can go out and look for yourself. I already did, White said. And Mr. McCall is correct. It's hard to see. I'll take a look, Virgil said. The big question is, how did they move the tranquilized cats? We have to figure out how and where they took the cats out of the zoo. This place is surrounded by houses. Maybe somebody has a security camera. Duncan said to Virgil, the crime scene guys have been up at that Minnetonka home invasion, but they were due back this afternoon. I'll check with B, see when she can get over here. Virgil asked, does anybody know if tranquilizer guns have to be registered? Or do you need any kind of prescription or whatever for the darts? I assume the things are dangerous. You wouldn't want somebody shooting a human being. No, you wouldn't. The dose that would put Artur to sleep would kill a human, Beth said. The rest of it, you'd have to ask one of our vets. I'd like to get one of the vets to check your stock of darts and see if they're all accounted for, Virgil told Landseer. She nodded. I'll do that right now. One more question. This might sound stupid. Is it possible that the tigers are still here in the zoo, in some unused cage or den, and the thieves plan to take them out later? I mean, if they don't seem to have gone through the only exit. Everyone sat up, looked at each other, and then the director. And Landseer said, oh my goodness, nobody ever asked that question. I'll have the zoo searched immediately. There are a few places where they could be kept. Wouldn't that be wonderful to find them here? Might want to tell your searchers to be careful, Duncan said. Wouldn't want to unexpectedly walk in on a couple of hungry tigers. Virgil turned to Best. Could you show me around? I'd like to talk to the guy who heard the shots last night. Joel Charvin. I've got him standing by, and Bob Marino, he's the one who spotted the cut fences. Let's go, Virgil said. You gotta hurry, McCall said. Those tigers are in a world of trouble. 5. Virgil and Best found Charvin and Moreno in a break room. Charvin, a short, thin man who looked like he might lift weights, didn't have much to contribute except the time frame. I think it was right around 1:30 I was collecting trash and I heard the sounds, these pat-pat-pat sounds. I was on the other side of the zoo and I looked over toward where the sounds came from. That's off to the west. The moon was going down. The bottom of the moon was touching the horizon. You should be able to check the time from that. I was told these guns are fairly quiet, but you could hear them on the other side of the zoo? Virgil asked. Sort of. I didn't know what they were. Never even thought they might be a tranquilizer gun, Charvin said. They were just different sounds than what I usually hear at night. Could have been somebody doing a golf clap, like clap, clap, clap. 3 times, not 2? Virgil asked. Charvin thought for a moment, his eyes half shut, then said, yeah, 3. Clap, clap, clap. There was some time between the sounds, maybe a minute. Okay, good, Virgil said. Anything else? Nope. I was working on the other side of the zoo, like I said, and didn't hear anything more. There's houses on the other side of the zoo fence, and McAndrew's Road is over there to the south, so there's always some noise. I didn't think any more about it until we found out the tigers were gone. They talked for a couple of more minutes, then Virgil let Charvin go, and he, Best, and Moreno walked around the animal containment areas to the edge of the tiger exhibit. A chain-link fence kept people on the path, and the tiger area itself was enclosed by a heavy black chain-link fence that Virgil estimated to be 15 to 20 feet high. Virgil didn't immediately see the cut in the first fence until Moreno pointed it out. Whoever had cut the fence had cut from the bottom up, a hole 3.5 feet wide and 2 feet high, with the wires on the left edge left uncut so the fence could be swung open like a door. When they left, the thieves had pushed the fence back in place and had fixed it there by taping some of the cut ends with narrow strips of silver duct tape, which were hard to see even if you knew what you were looking for. Anybody would miss that in the dark. Can't blame the security guys, Virgil said. Bess said, they cut the hole in the tiger cage right over there. All three of them clambered over the pathway fence and walked to the tiger enclosure. They found the same shape hole cut in the tiger fence, but the cut ends were taped together with black duct tape. Somebody thought about this a lot. There was serious planning going on, Virgil said. He got down on his hands and knees and examined the grass next to the cut, then looked up at Moreno and Best. Take a look at this. Tell me what you see. The two men got down on their hands and knees and scrutinized the grass near the cut. Moreno spoke first. There's a line. You can barely see it. Oh, yeah, Best said. I see it. It's straight. Not a shoe print. I think it's a wheel, Virgil said. They took them out of here on a dolly, Moreno said. I think so. Keep people away from here, especially the grass. Our crime scene people will want to take a look. Virgil looked into the cage and asked, anything in there now? Best shook his head. No. Virgil grabbed the fence and carefully pulled it free of the tape splices, not touching the tape. He told the other two not to touch it and to be careful where they put their hands, knees, and feet, and all three of them crawled into the tiger enclosure. The enclosure was a pleasant piece of rolling ground, well-treed, with a small pond, but not a tiger jungle, Virgil thought. He wondered if the tigers knew the difference. He looked at the pond and asked, tigers swim? Yeah, they do. They're not like house cats, Beth said. Virgil led the way to the highest point and motioned back to the cut fence. The tigers had to be between here and the fence. Couldn't see them from anywhere else, which makes me wonder, how did they know the tigers would be up here? I was talking to one of the keepers, not today, but a while ago, and he said tigers like to hang slightly below the top of a hill where they're not silhouetted, but they're up high, Best said. From there, they can see and hear everything, but they're hard to see themselves. An insider would probably know where they hung out. Moreno. Only an insider would know that we were letting them stay outside on hot nights. They looked around a hillside, and Virgil had just said, okay, let's go, when Moreno said, look at this. He was pointing at the bottom of a tree at the top of the hill. Virgil went to look and saw a pencil-shaped dart with a furry red tail. Dart. Must have missed once, Best said. That's why Charvin heard three shots. Could be fingerprints, Virgil said. We'll leave it for the crime scene guys. They eased back through the hole in the tiger fence and climbed back over the pathway fence, careful not to touch the grooves that might have been made by a dolly or wagon. From the hole in the pathway fence, Bess said, the animals were carried, or rolled, along a service road to a metal gate where the key was used. Virgil looked at the lock and agreed that it must have been a key. Doesn't look like it was picked, not a scratch on it. That's what Officer White thinks, Moreno said. From the gate, Best said, the tigers were probably taken out to the parking lot. They could see the lot from where they were. Virgil studied it for a while, then said, The parking lot is the obvious spot, but what are the other options? Say they've got the tigers on a dolly, and they're moving them through the gate, and they want to stay on a hard surface. How would they get them out from there? Best asked. That second camera is way out by the only entrance, and nobody went in or out. Once they had the tigers on a dolly, or maybe a couple of dollies, moving them wouldn't be that hard, Virgil said. Where could they move them where the camera wouldn't see them? Best scratched his head, then said, Well, they could take them behind the service buildings. There's a perimeter road over there that backs up to a regular street. There's a fence around all of it, right?
Yeah.
Let's go look, Virgil said. The three of them hiked over to the far edge of the parking lot, and Moreno pointed out the adjoining street through a screen of trees and brush. They walked along the perimeter fence, and 100 yards up, Virgil saw the tape used to put the chain-link fence back together. There. Kiss my ass, Best said. He looked back toward the zoo buildings. They killed that camera because they were afraid it could see out here. Even if they didn't come in with a truck, they were afraid that it might pick them up. What happened was, they wanted the shortest line to get out of the tiger enclosure to a hard surface, which is why they had to get through that locked gate, Virgil said, as they looked back along the line of flight. Once they were on the road, with a tiger on a dolly, they could roll it without working too hard. Then they needed to get to a place where it was the shortest distance to their vehicle. They crawled through the hole in the perimeter fence, which led them into the backyard of a house. They trooped through the yard and around to the front, where they found a for sale sign. Virgil went to the front door, rang the doorbell, got no response, pounded on the door, then tramped through a flower bed and looked through a front window. It's staged, he told the others. I don't think there's anybody living here. Let's go around back again. The house had a double garage with a door leading into the backyard. The edge of the door was cracked, with a thin line of raw wood showing around the lock where somebody had used a tool to force the door. When Virgil placed his fingers against the top of the door and pushed, the door popped open. The garage was empty, but in the center of it, they saw a small dark splotch on the concrete. That could be blood, Virgil said, squatting down to look at it. He'd seen blood on concrete any number of times. Let's move out of here without messing anything up. Stay away from the line between the door and the fence. We'll see if we can spot any more wheel marks. It took a while, but they did. Now we know how they did it, Moreno said, looking back at the fence line. They loaded the cats on dollies, rolled them out of the exhibit, across the road, down here to the garage, where they probably had a truck waiting. Could even have a truck with a lift, like a moving truck. They had to have scouted out the house ahead of time, Virgil said. I need to talk to the neighbors, see if anybody noticed any strange trucks or vans, or a truck going in the garage when it shouldn't have been. I bet your crime scene people will be able to make something out of this, Best said.
I bet they won't, Virgil replied.
Best tipped his head.
They won't?
Probably not. They're good at collecting evidence, if there's any, but that's usually most useful in a trial, or maybe in a real long investigation where you're looking at hundreds of possibilities and you're trying to eliminate some of them, Virgil said. But you know, you find dolly wheel marks. How many people have dollies in their garages? You find Nike patterned shoe prints. How many people wear Nikes?
That's not really determinative evidence. This was well enough planned that I don't think we're going to find a whole bunch of fingerprints.
We might, but I doubt it. How about the blood? Best asked.
DNA.
DNA's great, but that could be tiger blood, if it's blood at all. Then if it's human, and you really push on a critical need-to-know-right-now basis and get priority DNA examination, it'll take you 3 days to get results. That's chemistry, not bureaucracy, Virgil said. If it's human blood, and if the blood happens to be in the criminal database, then that's good. But 3 days for processing. The way the people back in the office were talking, we might not have 3 days. Jesus. I love those tigers, Moreno said. He was wearing a blue L.A. Dodgers hat, but took it off and curled the bill in his hands.
If somebody turns them into hairballs for some Chinese hairball, I'll shoot them myself.
And let's get back, Virgil said. We need to get crime scene down here, and I need to start calling people. Crime scene was on the way, and Virgil, back at the zoo headquarters, sent them straight to the house outside the fence. He told Beatrice Sawyer, the head crime scene tech, about the spot of blood and the splintered door and the tape on the fences, the tracks in the dirt, and the dart that waited in the tiger enclosure. Anything you can get will help, he said. I have nothing that points in any particular direction. Then he called the real estate agent who'd listed the house for sale, told him that it had been broken into,
warned him not to go into it,
but asked him to meet in the driveway in an hour. The agent said he would be there. The owners are in Moorhead. They relocated there. You want them to come back? If they have any idea at all of who might know about their house, yeah, I'd like to talk to them, Virgil said. I'll call them, the agent said. Virgil called the Apple Valley police, talked to the chief,
told him about the break-in at the house where the tigers had been taken, and asked him to send a couple of cops around.
Tell them to stay out of the house. The crime scene guys are on their way. The media is going to hear about it, and we need to keep them backed off.
We can do that, the chief said.
He took a call from Lucas Davenport, who had been Virgil's boss at the BCA before he got pissed off and quit.
Dell called, and he told me they put you on this tiger hunt, and that some people think the thieves are going to kill the tigers to make Chinese medicine. That right?
Yeah, I'm out at the zoo now, trying to figure it out, Virgil said.
Everybody else is protecting the state fair from the Purdy's. The fact that the Purdy's are dead doesn't seem to make any difference.
Listen, when that black hole case was going on a couple of years back, I interviewed a guy named Toby Strait. He lives down I-35. He sells black bear gallbladders to the Chinese. He's right on the line between legal and illegal most of the time, and I know damn well he handles illegally shot bears during the hunting season. I don't know that he'd handle tigers, but he might. If he doesn't, he might know who would.
Lucas, I gotta talk to that guy. You got a location?
Nah, we're up north right now. I'm working on my cabin, Davenport said. His phone isn't listed anywhere either. He keeps changing them, buying burners. I'll be back home tomorrow, and I'll fire up my database and get a number to you.
Nobody has access to the database down here?
No, it's on a hard drive at my house, and it's encrypted, Davenport said.
Get back to me as soon as you can, Virgil said. If people are right about the medicine thing, these guys will kill the tigers.
Might already have done it, and if they haven't, they'll do it soon.
I'd go back tonight and look it up, but by the time I got home, it'd be too late to do anything, Davenport said. I'll call you in the morning.
At zoo headquarters, the media had shown up in their vans and were setting up for the press conference. Virgil hung back, but watched Landseer, the zoo director, go through the routine. There was no information on the tigers. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension was all over the case. They hoped to have the tigers back soon, etc. Duncan took his turn under the lights, said that the Attorney General had promised to prosecute the thieves to the fullest extent of the law. Duncan read a list of felonies that the perpetrators had already committed and said that upon conviction, those crimes would lead to 36 years in prison. He added that since there was no market for tiger parts in Minnesota, interstate commerce was probably involved in the theft, and that Amur tigers were on the federal endangered species list. Those were federal offenses, and the FBI was sending agents to help with the case, and federal charges were pending. Landseer finished by saying, I appeal to the people who have these animals, for the sake of the tigers, and for your own sake. Tell us where they are. Return them to us. If you do not, I believe you will spend the rest of your lives regretting your crime.
Not bad, Virgil thought.
Landseer and Duncan had barely finished their statements when the TV people started tearing down lights and hurrying back to their vans. Not typical behavior in Virgil's experience. They usually asked questions so each reporter could get his or her face on screen. He wandered over to a cameraman he knew and asked, "What's the rush?"
"We're going to a crime scene house around the block," the cameraman said. "You want to be on TV? I'm sure the talent would be happy to have you."
"Nah."
He walked back to the house where the tigers had been taken. Beatrice Sawyer was there with the BCA crime scene truck. The neighbors, Virgil thought, had spotted the truck and had called the TV stations. The vans were setting up a block down the street, held back by two Apple Valley cops. Sawyer was around at the back of the house, looking at the door.
"Where did all the TV come from?" she asked.
"Press conference at the zoo. The zoo's on the other side of the fence." She looked down the street at the truck, then back to Virgil.
"Glad I'm not Virgil," she said.
Neighborhood rubberneckers were out in force, standing on their lawns, watching the crime scene crew moving back and forth between the van and the house. The real estate agent, whose name was Vance, and who was too old and balding for his gelled hair, showed up, towed through the police lines by one of the Apple Valley cops. Three couples had looked at the house over the past 2 months, he said, and he would find it hard to believe that any of them were involved in the tiger theft.
"They're all middle-aged, middle-income, pre-approved people. FICO scores in the 700s and 800s, he said. "We did have an open house 2 weeks ago, and maybe 15 people came, but we didn't take names on those."
Vance didn't have much more. Virgil took his card and turned him over to an Apple Valley cop to escort outside the blocked-off area. He was inside the garage talking to Sawyer about the spot on the concrete, which she also thought was blood, when the cop came back with a kid.
"Kid needs to talk to you," the cop said.
"What's up?" Virgil asked.
The boy was maybe 16 or 17, thin, had been through a couple of episodes of acne, and was carrying a skateboard. He looked at B, then back at Virgil, and said,
"This is kind of private."
Virgil said, "All right, let's go outside." They walked around to the side of the garage, and the kid said,
"You can't tell any of the people this. The neighbors."
"Well, what do you got?" Virgil asked.
"Last night I was up at my girlfriend's house."
The kid nodded up the street.
"We were, you know, up in her bedroom, fooling around. Her parents were down in Missouri taking her sister to college, and they weren't supposed to get home until today. They got home last night instead. Like, really late."
"Caught you," Virgil said.
"Nah, it sounds stupid, but I went out her window and snuck through some backyards before I went out to the street. When I went out, I saw a van coming out of this garage."
"What kind of a van?" Virgil asked.
"A white one, like a panel van, like vans have, with those white windows that you can't see inside of. Pretty big van, but it could get in the garage even with the door down. When I saw the door coming up, I kind of hid. I thought it was the Schmitz coming out, and I didn't want them to see me. They don't like me because I'm a skater. And they're kind of narcs, you know. They're friends with my girlfriend's parents, and they'd rat me out. They'd know where I was coming from."
Virgil had learned from Vance, the real estate agent, that the owners of the house were named Schmidt.
"You know what time this was?"
"I called my girlfriend when I got home to tell her that everything was chill and to find out if everything was chill with her. I saw on my phone that it was a little after 2 o'clock.
They talked about the van some more. The kid wasn't sure about it, but thought the van might be a Chevrolet.
"I don't know why I think that, but I do," he said.
The kid had one additional interesting fact. When the van came out of the garage door light didn't go on. "Lights always come on when a garage door goes up or down," he said. They walked around the corner of the garage, and Virgil looked up at the door lift mechanism, which showed a white plastic cover over what should be a light bulb. He hit the wall switch, and the garage door started down, but the light didn't come on. He stopped the door and ran it back up. Still no light.
B. Sawyer had watched him do that and said, "Somebody unscrewed the bulb?"
"I think so," Virgil said.
"We'll check the whole thing," she said. "That's a good find." Virgil and the teenager went back outside, where Virgil slapped the kid on the back and said, "You did really good. You've got a sharp eye and some balls to come over and tell me this. Maybe you ought to be a cop." The kid brightened. "You think?"
"Why not? Take a test or something. See if you got the aptitude.
Talk to your school counselor. See what he thinks," Virgil said.
"That guy's a dick," the kid said. "He already told me I'll be washing dishes the rest of my life."
"Fuck him," Virgil said. "I hate people who tell kids things like that. You do the best you can and forget about him."
"Okay, but listen, don't tell anybody about, you know, sneaking out of my girlfriend's house."
"You're good with me," Virgil said.
When the kid was gone, escorted back through the police lines by the Apple Valley cops, Virgil called Duncan, who was caught in traffic halfway back to St. Paul. "We're looking for a white van, blocked out white windows, larger than standard, maybe a Chevy. No other information. The thieves could have had their own, but we need to get Sandy calling all the local rental places."
"I'll talk to her when I get back, if I ever get back," Duncan said. "Sounds like you're rolling."
"Got lucky," Virgil said. "From here on out, it's going to get harder." He hung up, and from behind him, B, who was standing on a stepladder squinting at the light bulb in the garage door lift mechanism, said,
"Hey, we got some prints."
"Really?"
Virgil said. He was interested, but not excited.
"I got $2, says they've got nothing to do with this."
As the afternoon, then evening, wore on, Virgil walked around to all the houses on the block, introducing himself and asking about the white van and about possible security cameras. The neighbors were cooperative, but he got nothing but the aerobic exercise. The Apple Valley chief stopped by, found Virgil, and when Virgil told him what he was doing, offered to send a few more cops around to the nearby blocks, asking the same question. Virgil took him up on it, and a half hour later, cops were interrogating people across a 5-block range. The neighborhood was intensely residential, though, and except for one insomniac, who had seen a late-night white van in the neighborhood, right time, right place, but not as much information as the kid had provided, there were no surveillance cameras of the kind found on convenience stores and gas stations. None of the 3 churches in the neighborhood or the elementary school had cameras looking out at the street. The crime scene crew had finished with the garage. B had gotten good prints off the light bulb and had sent digital copies to BCA headquarters to be relayed to the FBI, and she confirmed the spot on the floor was blood, species unknown. The crew was now working along the route that the tiger thieves had taken across the zoo property, looking for anything else that might help. Virgil walked back to Landseer's office to watch the press conference on the evening news. He and Landseer stood together in front of the TV, and Landseer said, "We're not missing any tranquilizer darts. They're all accounted for, and they all have international orange tails, not red."
"Okay."
The news came up, and a reporter named Daisy Jones, whom Virgil considered a possible sexual refuge if all else failed, and whom he suspected of classifying him in the same way, did a quick rundown of the investigation so far and a follow-up interview with John Duncan. Duncan was smooth on camera and stacked up the threats of long prison sentences and remorseless investigation. "We will get the cats back, and we will send these jokers to prison." When she was done with Duncan, Jones turned back to the camera and said, "Duncan tells us that the BCA's top investigator, Virgil Flowers, has been assigned to the Tiger recovery. Flowers has been involved in a number of high-profile cases that have resulted in major convictions."
Duncan said that he thought the result here would be the same, that Flowers would get the tigers back to the zoo and send the thieves to long terms at Stillwater Prison.
Landseer, who was watching the show with Virgil, said,
"That's very flattering. I'm glad to have you on the case."
Virgil said, "Daisy never flatters without a motive.
I expect she'll be calling me in the next 5 minutes.
He took a call a few minutes later, not from Daisy Jones, but from Frankie.
I wasn't kidding about sleeping over, and I'm not going to wreck my back on your crappy old mattress. And I've had baby mattresses that smelled better. Anyway, I'm down at Slumberland, and I'm buying us a new one. The question is, California King or Eastern King?
What's the difference?
California is a little longer, but a little narrower, Frankie said. I'm thinking we go that way, because I don't take up much space, and you need the length.
Let's do that, then. Will it fit in my bedroom?
I measured. If you get back tonight, we can give it a test drive, she said.
You can get it tonight?
I can get it in 20 minutes, she said.
Well, see you tonight.
Before you buy it, though, talk to the manager, Virgil said. Make sure it can take a vicious pounding.
I'll be sure to ask, she said.
Virgil got off the phone, now distracted. Somehow, buying a bed with his girlfriend felt like an important step. There were, he suspected, extensive implications to the purchase, about which most women could have long consultations in coffee shops. He shuddered and called John Duncan.
I'm going home, Virgil said. I'll be back early tomorrow.
Why don't you crash in a motel?
I don't have my stuff, Virgil said. I left in a rush, and it's less than an hour from here anyway. I can be back before anybody wakes up tomorrow. I've got some household chores to do, and I'll pack up a bag in the morning.
Hate household chores, Duncan said. 2 days later, you gotta do it all over again.
I hear you, brother, Virgil said.
Later that night, a sweaty Frankie said, Let's do that all over again.
Gotta get up early, Virgil said.
Not before you finish the household chores, she said. He was about to finish the chores when an image popped up in his mind. A tall, broad-shouldered, naked blonde about to dive into the swimming hole.
Sparkle? That you?
6. Winston Peck the Sixth was standing in his driveway, smoking a Marlboro, double garage door in the up position, when Zhang Xiaomin wheeled his Ferrari California around the corner, dropped it into second, and accelerated up the street, generating enough racket to wake the heavily tranquilized. He pulled into the driveway, revved the engine a few times to annoy anyone who hadn't already been awake, so they could witness his involvement with Peck. Zhang got out of his car with a selfie grin, as though he expected to be congratulated and possibly photographed. Peck snapped his cigarette out into the street and said,
X, for God's sakes, what are you doing? Put the car in the garage and get in the fucking house.
Zhang, a slender man of middling height, wearing a black silk athletic suit with a small tiger's face on the breast, poked a finger at him.
You do not speak to me like this. You know who I am.
Yeah, you're the son of a Chinese rich guy who thinks you're a worthless pain in the ass.
Zhang dropped into a combat stance, 2 fingers extended in a snake hand.
Bring it, he said.
Peck said,
Oh, fuck you.
Get the money.
I want to see the cats before you get money, Zhang said.
Peck looked at him with what he hoped was a hard, intimidating glare, then said,
Put your car in the garage. I want it out of sight.
Zhang took his time doing that, careful not even to brush any of the various brooms, shovels, snowblowers, or racks in Peck's garage. A 1-inch scratch on a Ferrari was maybe 10 grand, if you wanted a perfect Ferrari, and his father did.
The car was in his father's name, not his.
As Zhang eased the car into the garage, Peck thought about what a perfect dumb motherfucker Zhang actually was. Zhang's father, on the other hand, was not. Zhang Min was a Chinese refugee currently ensconced in Pasadena, California, where he was easing back into criminal activity after fleeing his life of industrial crime in China. The elder Zhang had noticed,
this wasn't hard, that there were 2.2 million former mainland Chinese living in the United States, effectively cut off from their supply of traditional and illegal Chinese medicine. A fast man to sniff out an underserved market, he'd begun weaving a drug distribution network centered in Los Angeles. His problem was supply. Peck was part of his answer. Peck went into his house and found a ski mask he actually used for cross-country skiing, then backed his Tahoe out. He pointed Zhang at the passenger side of the Tahoe, dropped the garage door. Peck took them out to I-94 and east out of St. Paul.
"How's your father still doing well?"
"He is angry, as always," Zhang said.
"Angry with me? With us?"
"With me," Zhang said. "He is impossible to please."
"He is sort of an asshole. But we need him, you and I. At least for the time being."
Zhang looked out the window, scowling. When they passed Radio Drive, Peck handed Zhang the ski mask and said,
"Put it on backward. You can roll up the bottom enough to breathe."
"I'm not gonna—"
"You do it, or we go back and forget the whole thing," Peck said. "That would make the old man happy, huh? Dropping everything? I'm not gonna let you see where we're going, X."
Peck couldn't actually pronounce Xiaomin's first name, and they agreed he could shorten it to X, which X seemed to like.
"You run your mouth too much. You do stupid shit all the time. It's my ass on the line, too."
"Fuck you," Zhang said, but he pulled the mask on backward, leaving the end of his nose and mouth exposed. Peck drove on for a few more miles to Manning Avenue, got off the highway, turned north, did a couple of laps around the parking lot of a Holiday station to confuse things, then went back out to Manning Avenue and turned south.
"Are we there?" Zhang asked. "I'm getting carsick." "Hang on for another couple of minutes," Peck said. "Don't go puking in my truck."
The farm was 8 or 9 miles out, a run-down place waiting for the suburbs to arrive. The house had last been lived in by two community college students 2 years earlier. It had functioning electricity, a functioning well, a semi-functioning septic system that the day before had leaked water onto the yard, which Peck had stepped in, and a barn out back. The farm was owned by a New York investor, the guy waiting for the suburbs to arrive. They pulled into the barnyard and Peck said,
"You can take the mask off."
Hake Simonian came out and stood in the headlights, a burly man in a blood-spattered apron, carrying a long skinning knife in one hand. He was smoking one of his black flames, a yellowish cloud of nicotine and tar swirling around his head. Peck turned the headlights off, and then he and Zhang walked to the barn where Simonian said,
"We still got a long way to go. What are you doing here? Why's this asshole here?"
"I need to show X that we got them," Peck said. "It's a money thing."
Simonian said, "We got more than tigers. We got a whole shitload of trouble. You been watching the TV?"
"No, but we knew they'd freak out. More than that, they put the state cops on the case. The state DA says they're going to catch us, and they've got enough crimes already to lock us up for 30 years. Life, if we kill the tigers."
"Nonsense.
Besides, they're not going to catch us," Peck said. "There won't be the hair of a tiger around here in a week."
"Where are the cats?" Zhang asked.
"Inside," Simonian said. He tipped his head toward the barn door.
Simonian was wearing cargo shorts, flip-flops, and an L.A. Dodgers t-shirt under the plastic apron. All the clothing showed splashes and speckles of blood. He led the way into the barn, where three work lights provided high-contrast lighting over the central part of the barn floor. The dead male tiger was hanging from a ceiling hook above a big blue plastic tarp. The tarp was smeared with blood. The tiger's hide had been removed and was lying on another tarp at one side of the barn floor, like a cheap rug. The naked torso of the tiger might have been a huge, oversized man, except for the head, where the bared teeth shone like antique ivory daggers. The whole place smelled of blood, intestinal sludge, tiger poop, and sweat. Simonian nodded at a row of Tupperware containers on the floor near the pelt.
Eyes, whiskers, claws, balls, cock, all separate, like you said. I'm looking at the pictures and I can get the kidneys and liver, but I sort of fucked up the spleen.
You gotta be more careful. That spleen was probably worth a couple grand all by itself, Peck said, peering at the heavy naked muscles of the tiger's body. Simonian said,
all I got is a comic book picture of his guts to go by. Anyway, I still got it, only it's sort of mushed up.
Keep it then, but get it in the dryer before it goes bad, Peck said. And to Zhang, you satisfied?
Yeah.
Zhang had walked a long circle around the hanging torso, continuing to the back where the female tiger stared at them from her cage. A few feet from her cage, he made a sudden aggressive move forward. The tiger reacted, moving forward herself, but faster, harder than anything Zhang was capable of. Zhang jumped back, startled, laughed nervously, and then turned to Peck and said,
can I shoot her?
Not now, Peck said, the irritation riding in his voice. We don't have a lot of refrigeration here, as you can see, so we need to keep her alive until we're done with the big boy. Zhang went over and stroked Artur's pelt, then picked it up. The hide was heavy, and he strained to lift it.
Help me put it on my shoulders. I want to take a picture of it.
No, Peck said. Put it down. You hear what Haig said about 30 years? All you need is a picture of you with a tiger skin on your head on Facebook. Put it down.
Zhang dropped the pelt like a rag.
You guys are pussies. Simonian said, what? Zhang poked a finger at him, as he had with Peck. I said.
Simonian stepped toward him, and Zhang slipped back in his snake pose.
Simonian turned to Peck and asked, what the fuck is that?
A martial art thing, Peck said. It's the beaver stance or something.
Simonian said, yeah?
And casually reached out and slapped Zhang on the side of the head, nearly flattening him.
Then he slapped him 4 or 5 more times, making a rapid pop-pop-pop sound, using alternate hands, as though Zhang's head was a speed bag.
Peck said, okay, knock it off, knock it off.
Simonian stopped and said, martial bullshit. And Peck said to Zhang, who'd staggered to the side wall and was leaning back against it, you've seen the cats, let's go. Outside, Zhang held one hand to an ear, and with the other, poked a finger at Peck.
I'll come back and kill him. I'll come back and tear his heart out and eat it raw.
There was a bit of blood under one of his nostrils and at the right corner of his mouth.
X. Hake could beat you to death by accident. You're a silly, useless asshole, and you've got to learn to live with that, Peck said. Get in the fucking truck.
You will tell Hake to treat me with respect.
Hake's basically your father's man, Peck said. I don't tell him much.
Winston Peck VI was the son, grandson, great-grandson, great-great-grandson, and great-great-great-grandson of physicians, going back to Winston I, who served with distinction in the Union Army during the Civil War. Peck VI had actually gotten an M.D. degree, by the skin of his teeth, only to be subsequently banned from the profession for unusually intrusive examinations of young female clients during his residency at a medical clinic in Indianapolis.
He had been lucky to escape sexual assault charges.
For what? Copping a feel? Nothing that didn't happen every Saturday night behind the local high school. And the women had been unconscious,
so they didn't even really experience it.
All very discouraging. After that episode, he'd moved to St. Paul to be close to the money of his mother, first wife of Peck V. But when she died young, in her early 60s, he was appalled to find that most of her estate went to her second husband. Peck was dismissed with $100,000, which had lasted a bit more than a year. Still, he had the M.D. degree. They might not let him practice, but they couldn't take the degree away, and reinvented himself as an authority on traditional Chinese, Indian, Vietnamese, and Native American medicine, whatever the buckskin and bead set seemed to be indulging itself with. Life was hard, though, and he was considering immigration to Sedona, Arizona, where the pickings might be better,
when he'd encountered Zhang Min at a traditional medicine convention. After several friendly conversations, each recognized the innate criminality in the other, and an arrangement was reached. Peck would supply, Zhang Min would distribute. The early medicines were derived from African and Asian sources routed through Canada. Eventually, some of the more demanding clients asked about getting the tip-top quality of product as derived from endangered tigers and rhinos. The money was big and led to the raid on the Minnesota Zoo, though the whole idea had left Peck scared shitless. 2 certified endangered Amur tigers. Fewer than 600 of them remained in the wild, and no privately held tigers were known to be Amurs. A good Amur could provide medicines to increase libido, improve sagging male potency, repair liver and lung damage, and cure incontinence and irritable bowels. Zhang Min was no fool, and he wanted proof that he would be getting what he was paying for. He supplied assistance in the form of the Simonian brothers, whom he met through Armenian gang contacts in Glendale, and he also sent his ne'er-do-well son to keep an eye on things.
"So I have now seen these things," Zhang said through the wool of the ski mask that was again covering his eyes. "I will inform my father tonight. When will we get the medicines?"
"Some of it, like the powdered whiskers, we can FedEx out right away," Peck said. "Other parts will take a while. They have to be dried, purified, and ground up. That takes time. He should start getting the more powerful stuff, like the ground femur, in a couple of weeks. But I've got a lot on the line here. I want to see the money. If I don't, I've got other customers. Your father jumped the line."
"Because of his money."
"That was an important part of it," Peck said, unembarrassed. "So how old is your stepmother?"
"She is not my stepmother yet," Zhang said, the resentment boiling in his voice. He turned away to look out the window.
"Okay, I forget. How old is your father's fiancé?"
15, Zhang said after a moment.
"My, my. Do the police know?"
"This is an internal Chinese matter," Zhang said. "It is arranged between our family and her family."
"Yeah, arranged in San Francisco, where Chinese arrangements are not always in line with accepted American core values, or laws, for that matter. Putting the pork to a 15-year-old may be pleasurable, right up to the doors of San Quentin, or wherever California puts the pederasts now."
Zhang jabbed a finger at him. "You will keep your mouth shut about this."
"She a looker?"
"She has attractions,"
Zhang admitted after a moment.
"Ooh. Big tits? Is that what we're talking here? Big tits on a 15-year-old? How's her ass? Nice and tight?"
I would think this arrangement would make you unhappy," Peck said. "How old are you, X? 40? Your stepmother will be, what, 25 years younger than you? A hot Chinese chick could keep your old man turned on forever. She could be pooping out babies for 20 years. What part of the fortune will you get?"
"Shut up,"
Zhang said.
"And I am 38.
We provide your father the medicine, all right. Maybe you and I could work out another arrangement on our own."
Long silence.
Zhang said, "I'm devoted to father."
"Of course you are," Peck said.
"We will take maximum care that all of these medicines are completely safe and non-lethal."
"Yes."
"When's the wedding?"
Peck asked.
2 months,
Zhang said.
"Huh. Forbes said your father has more than $100 million. I'm sure he'll leave you with at least $1 million.
"Shut up."
"How much does a Ferrari cost?"
"Shut up."
They rode in silence until Peck rolled around the gas station again, then back to I-94, where he told Zhang that he could remove the ski mask. Zhang peeled it off and said,
"You are a very bad man to make me think these things about my father."
"Yes, I am," Peck said. "I'm bad. Small-time bad. Your father is big-time bad. Evil in every sense of the word. As I understand it, the women working in his factories were no better than slaves.
that he had them beaten if they didn't meet production quotas, that he kept them locked in concrete cells, that some might have died there. Chinese articles on the net say he routinely forced the younger women to have sex with him, and that in the end, he took money that should have been theirs and ran to the U.S. The Chinese government says he left behind an environmental disaster at his battery factories. All so Americans can have their cheap cell phones, Zhang sneered.
I don't care why he did all that, to tell you the truth, Peck said. He's lived like a sultan for years. Too much rich food, too much booze, too many cigarettes. The fact is, he'll never see 70 the way he's going. He'll probably die in the next few years, and then this little Chinese flower will get all the money. From your point of view, it's too bad that he didn't die a little sooner, huh? It's the difference between a lifetime of used Toyota Corollas and a lifetime of private jets and new red Ferraris.
Shut up, Zhang said.
Used Corollas, Peck said. Of course, they do get a lot of miles per gallon, which is helpful if you're poor.
Shut up.
They were back at Peck's place 15 minutes later. He'd made some inroads, Peck thought. Old man Zhang would give him $250,000 cash, no taxes, for all the various medicines they could squeeze out of two adult Amur tigers. Young man Zhang might do much better than that, if properly blackmailed.
Get the money, he said as he rolled the garage door up.
Zhang got an Amazon mailing box from the floor of his car, and they went into the kitchen, where he opened it to reveal stacks of $50 bills. He counted out $25,000, beautiful engravings of Ulysses S. Grant, piling up on the dining table. The pile made Peck's heart flutter. Maybe he wasn't a total sociopath, he thought. He did love money. 7. Virgil got up at 7 o'clock, feeling that all was right with the world, though he knew it wasn't, never had been, and never would be. Honus was sleeping between Virgil and Frankie, yawned, and made Virgil yawn, then Virgil slapped Frankie on her lightly garbed butt and went to get cleaned up. The new bed was a complete success. His toes no longer hung over the end, and when he needed to dig them in, he could. Frankie squeezed into the bathroom as he was getting out of the shower, stared at herself in the fogged-up mirror for a moment, then asked, "Why do I look better when the mirror is fogged up?" Far too experienced to attempt an answer, Virgil said instead, "I hope those tigers are okay." Frankie yawned, stretched, and then rubbed the fog off the mirror with a squeak-squeak sound and asked, "You coming back tonight?" "If I can. I'm going to take my bag, though. You got to walk the dog and feed him. I don't have time this morning." "All right. Sparkle and Bill are over at the Castro factory," Frankie said. "Probably right now. They want to talk to workers going through the gate."
"You worried?"
"Yep. Me and Sparkle don't see eye to eye, but I don't want her to get hurt. Bill should give her some protection. I don't think they'd beat up anybody with a witness around."
"Would they?"
"I don't know that they'd beat up anybody at all," Virgil said.
"Most companies will beat you up with lawyers and PR ladies, not with goons. Not anymore."
"Well, this is old man Castro we're talking about. He's a throwback to the bad old days," Frankie said.
"You're sure Bill will be there?"
"Yeah, he speaks good Spanish, if Sparkle needs an interpreter."
"Tell you what, I'll swing by there, talk with him," Virgil said. "If the company people see me around, maybe they'll think twice."
Virgil was on the highway at 8 o'clock, listening to radio news programs out of the Twin Cities. The tigers were the first item. "The longer the tigers are missing, the more likely the outcome is to be tragic, according to experts on zoo thefts. We're speaking to Dr. Randolph Byrne of the American Association of Zoological Gardens. Good morning, Dr. Byrne." Virgil didn't think too much about the media, except to exploit them when he needed to. The media was like rain. When it was falling on your head, there wasn't much you could do about it. Unless, of course, you were a bureaucrat, in which case you ran around in circles and threw your hands in the air and prepared statements, none of which accomplished anything. Dr. Byrne told him nothing he needed to know, so he switched to a country station and listened to Terry Allen sing Bottom of the World, a song he didn't hear often enough. On the way north, he detoured off Highway 169 through Le Sueur, threaded his way across town and out into the countryside, where the Castro factory poked up like a brick thumb. Virgil turned into the dusty parking lot and saw Father Bill leaning against the hood of Sparkle's Mini Cooper Clubman, smoking a cigar. Virgil pulled up next to him and got out.
"Virgil," Bill said, with a square-toothed Hemingway grin. "You look different with your clothes on."
"Bill, where's Sparkle?"
"She's inside. Some factory functionary came out and asked her what she was doing, talking to people," Bill said. "She told him, and they invited her inside to talk to the manager. I wasn't invited."
"She okay?"
"I hope so. She does tend to bite off more than she can chew," Bill said.
Virgil looked at the factory, which resembled something he imagined a medieval madhouse might look like. Dirty white window frames scattered around a four-story dark brick wall, with massive chimneys belching steam into the summer air. Down at the far end of the building, trucks were unloading produce across receiving docks, and the odor of hot pickle and rotten vegetables mixed with truck diesel fumes and the smell of the corn maturing in the surrounding fields. Altogether, the familiar and not entirely pleasant perfume of industrial agriculture. The smoke from Bill's cigar didn't help.
"Hostile place," he said. "The people going in look pretty tough. Beat up, tired. Lots of illegals, I think," Bill said. "Mostly women here at the factory. Most of them weren't interested in talking to us. The ones that did said that everything was just fine. Sparkle thought maybe I should wear my collar out here, but I wasn't comfortable doing that, not without thinking about it for a while."
"People look scared at all?" Virgil asked.
"No, no. They look tired more than anything."
"Huh." They stood and looked at the factory for another minute, then Virgil gave Bill a business card with his private cell number on it and said, "If there's any kind of trouble, call me."
"I will. I've got to be to work by 4 o'clock, so I've got to be out of here before the first shift ends. I think Sparkle will be coming back alone this afternoon," Bill said. He blew smoke, then added, "I don't think there'll be any trouble here at the plant. If they give her any trouble, it'll be away from here."
"Well, let me know," Virgil said. He handed Bill a second card. "Give one to Sparkle." Virgil stopped at the zoo, talked to Landseer for a few minutes to see if anything interesting had come in. Emails with tips, ransom notes, abject confessions. Nothing had. "I'm frightened and quite depressed," she said. "I think the tigers may be gone forever."
"If it goes a week, I'd agree. If we can get a hint, a crack, anything soon, then we might be able to save them. If this is an insider job, or if an insider provided keys to the tiger areas, then we need to find and locate that guy," Virgil told her. "I know that managers don't like to do anything that would suggest to employees that you suspect them of wrongdoing."
"I won't do that, not without specific evidence," she said.
"But what I'd like you to do is to come up with a list of people you think would be most likely to be involved," Virgil said.
"You don't have to write anything down. Do it in your head. Maybe talk it over with somebody else you trust. Then we'll call them in together and mix in a bunch of people you're sure are not involved. In other words, make it a big meeting. I'll give a talk about the investigation and see if we can generate some tips."
"In other words, you want me to put the finger on a specific group of people, but disguise it so it looks like we're talking to everybody," Landseer said.
"Exactly right," Virgil said. "That way nobody feels oppressed or anything, but at the same time, we whisper in the ear of the guilty party, or somebody who knows who the guilty party is. Ethically, I'm not sure how that differs from me giving you a list of people to harass," Landseer said.
"Ethically, there might not be any theoretical difference, but nobody gets their feelings hurt.